Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, March 3rd, 2011. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. I'm talking to you tonight from Silicon Valley. I've been back for a week working away here, and I'm headed back to Tennessee tomorrow. It's been a fabulous trip, and it's been good to be warm for a week. Tonight, Money and Markets, and very brief Ask Catherine, and then a great interview with Blake Levitt, who I'm thrilled was able to join us on the Solari Report. We sent out with the subscriber notice, as promised, a PDF or a link to a PDF, and you can also link to it from the control panel. It's the list of the food DVDs that we talked about last month, and I just wanted to read the list. I've expanded it from what I talked about the top 10, but I expanded it. I called it Our List of Documentaries and One Movie to Help You Organize Conspiracies to Grow Fresh Food, Finance the Gardeners and Farmers Who Do, and Inspire the Children You Love to Eat Fresh Food. It turned out to be 26 documentaries and one movie. And you will never, it's really funny. I sat back and I looked at the whole list and I said, my friendship with Harry Blaser, who's the former head of Harry's Farmers Market, who I worked with in 2005. And this list, these documentaries completely reinvented my relationship with food. And so I really encourage you to dig out that list and take a look at those documentaries. I think it will really bless you. Anyway, our theme for tonight is waiting for the other shoe to drop. And I wanted to use that expression because it started when everybody got worried about Y2K, and then after that everybody was worried about peak oil. And there's been all these different sort of movements to get people to disinvest. But you get this feeling as events unfold and things get stranger and stranger that you literally stop acting and start waiting for the other shoe to drop. It has that feeling to it. And one of the things I've learned is that it's critical not to wait for any other shoe to drop. It's critical to keep building. I always say the future is built by those who act, not those who predict it won't exist. The feeling these days can feel like we're waiting for the other shoe to drop. The only thing is when it comes to your time and attention, I really encourage you, no matter how it feels, don't wait. Start getting to work. Start building your future. The money in markets, we're watching a period of unprecedented politics. It's only going to grow, so this is a long-distance run. One of the things you see is as more and more cash gets printed and more currencies around the world get debased, we have a tremendous amount of cash looking for a tangible place to go. We saw Blackstone pay billions this week for malls from Centro, but lots of merger and acquisition deals. And I said to somebody this week, well, if the world's coming to an end, how come Blackstone is so busy trying to buy it all up? And so the reality is we've got a lot of money looking to get out of cash and into tangible. In addition to sort of the politics of cash looking for a tangible place to go, there's an awful lot on the energy markets and the combination of energy markets and Twitter, sometimes called the color revolution. It's now being called the Twitter revolution. You really, really, I just cannot encourage you enough. If you have not read The Oil Card by Jim Norman or listened to our interview last year with Jim Norman on The Oil Card and the manipulation of the oil markets, I really encourage you to do so. It makes so much more sense to understand the politics of what's happening in the Middle East and globally if you understand the need for the what I would call the Anglo-American alliance to keep the oil price up, not down. It also helps you to understand that we've really embarked on an economy where we have an integration of warfare with economics. And so literally, I prop up the dollar. I'm America. I prop up the dollar by disrupting oil supplies in Libya with the Twitter revolution, et cetera. And that hurts Europe and China, which helps the dollar. But of course, you're talking about warfare, which really destroys economics and indicates or causes tremendous amounts of waste. But again, if you haven't read The Oil Card by Jim Norman, that's really on my list of top books. In Wisconsin, a very, very interesting situation, if only because of the size of the crowds now turning out to object to what's happening at the state. I put up a very important blog post last week. It turns out that the Republicans' reform budget bill included a provision to transfer power plants in the state on a no-bid basis. Now, I cannot tell you how important an event that would be if we start, and I've been predicting this for several years, but if we start watching assets being transferred by state and local governments, particularly at below market prices, it's another round, a very deeper round of privatization that subsidizes private interests, and it's very, very dangerous. And it's because of that it's particularly interesting. If you haven't seen it, it's up on the blog. A purported activist called the governor, the new Republican governor of the state of Wisconsin, and pretending to be one of the Koch, the billionaire, and proceeded to engage with the governor about what was really going on. And it's worth listening to, because one of the things I took from it is a real sense of how fragile the politics are and how out of the know the governor is. I mean, you really get a sense for someone who has very little political power of their own and is really highly dependent on vested interests in a way which is terribly, terribly dangerous. And I'm not surprised to see 100,000 people at the State House, and I hope they feel emboldened by the information coming out about what's really going on behind the scenes. But whether it's Wisconsin or what's going on in the Middle East, we are seeing a tremendous revolution of people now being galvanized, if anything, by the inflation and the acceleration of the changes. And it's only begun. One of the questions posted by a subscriber was, let me just read it. Social media and the risk to your popsicle index. Do you think that the growing influence that Twitter is having on certain demographic groups could create a disproportionate risk to your popsicle index? Example, Twitter has a demographic, so 25% blacks, 50 million users. Next, add to this large group the ever-growing population of disenfranchised youth who live in popsicle perfect middle America. Now, light the fuse with a Rodney King event. My guess is that with the quote-unquote Twitter revolution, we are watching a very interesting dynamic. For a long time, the people who have governed have used divide-and-conquer politics. So we see black against white, women versus against men, Democrat versus Republican in this country. But you constantly get these divide-and-conquer politics. But what we're watching, and we're seeing it in the Middle East, and we're seeing it all across this country, is the politics of the young being turned against an older generation. And the reality is you're not just harvesting the young in their natural state. You're harvesting the fact that they have real serious significant issues. And but they are also relatively easy to satisfy and trick. And so the divide and conquer politics of old versus young is going to increase, and increasingly, it's one of the most dangerous kinds of politics that can happen, because the younger are going to take the position, it's my turn now, and you guys have wasted the resources, and they're going to be easy to manipulate. So yes, it's something dangerous, it's something definitely to watch. The reality is, if you look at the debt and the currency debasement, the inflation in food and other essential costs has only just begun. So remember, this is going to be a long process, so we need to hold on to our hat. Under the topic, or sort of under the phrase, the lies get slicker, I received from an old colleague on Wall Street a very fancy PowerPoint presentation with a foreword from Mayor Bloomberg, Lieutenant Governor Ravitch, and his office mate in private life, Paul Volcker, basically describing a set of, it's a presentation you're going to see a lot these days. You're going to see it more over the next year or two, and I want to make sure one of my goals on the Salieri Report is that you don't fall into the trap. And basically what it's going to say is that we have an aging population, and we really can't afford Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, and everything that's happened has happened as a result of the financial irresponsibility of the American people. Now, I'm not saying that there's not some nuggets of truth in that, but the reality is it holds you within a paradigm that doesn't ask the question, wait a minute, trillions of dollars have disappeared, including illegally, where has that money gone and why, and what is the governance process that would allow that, as opposed to, you know, lead another process that had us dealing with our financial questions and issues over the last 20 years. So that's sort of big question number one. Big question number two is, well, you know, the Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security costs assume that we continue to behave the way we behave, and I've talked before about all sorts of questions of, you know, assumptions behind the health bill and health care. And holding those assumptions silent or set is another one of the really big lies. So you look at this presentation, and it's very good at leading us where we want to go, which is sort of to cut health care, to cut a lot of the social safety net. My fear is it's going to be misused in the wrong way. So I really want you to be careful as you see all of that, because you're getting a really high-quality presentation that's full of some very big lies, and it's coming from people who were very much part of the shenanigans. Richard Ravitch, who is one of the names on the forward, Lieutenant Governor of New York, and I've described this, you can do a search for his name on the blog, was the person who over dinner at Jockey Club said to me on his HUD housing and government-subsidized housing, what do I care if people have jobs as long as I get government subsidies? And that's a quote, and you'll find it on the blog. So be careful, because the lies are getting slicker. Now, there's always somebody ready to ask the right question at the right time. We put up Matt Taibbi's wonderful interview with Amy Goodman up on the blog, asking the question from his newest article in Rolling Stone, why is no one in jail? This is a very good question. And Charlie Ferguson, who made the documentary Inside Job, we highlighted it last year in the Salieri Report in our Let's Go to the Movies section, won the Oscar Sunday night for Best Documentary, got up to the podium, accepted his Oscar with his partner, and then asked the question, why is no one in jail? Now, it was a marvelous moment, and the video of that is up on the blog. You can just see it's a very quick minute or two to watch him ask the question. But expect this question to percolate and simmer around some more, because it goes to the heart of what is happening and understand what is happening, and it's a very, very good question. On the Washington front, we watched the debt limit conversation get pushed out to April. The government borrows money. There is a limit within the budget process. There is a limit as to how much debt can be issued, and it requires an act of Congress to take the limit up. So you can literally, in the process of governance and financial management in Washington, you can get to a moment where you hit the debt limit and you can't issue more treasuries, and suddenly, literally, government operations have to come to a stop. There was a big brouhaha. It happened when I was in Washington in 1995, and Rubin used the Exchange Stabilization Fund to finance the government and keep it opening despite the hitting of the debt limit, which sort of poked a hole in the Republican strategy. And I think was part of the decision to finally move so much money out of the government and out of Washington you know, the fear that literally you had a mechanism that could no longer reconcile the financial issues. You'll see a lot of very bad coverage on the debt limit. The debt limit is really, you know, something, if Congress wants to, they can rewrite the debt limit to any amount. So the notion that the government's going to default because the debt limit is really a bunch of hooey. The way they solved the debt limit conversation this time is Treasury just announced that they now projected that they were fine until April 15th, which of course is the filing date for individual taxes. March 15th is corporations. But it's a very important date where you have a divided House and Congress, as we do now with the Republican and Democrats. There's a lot that's going to get fought out within that debt limit. So keep an eye on April 15th and what happens. We saw an article. I normally don't bring up Dean Baker, who is a policy analyst in Washington, but he had an article. He came out with not a lie as profoundly sort of evil as the Bloomberg Ravitch Volcker one, but what I call a modified hangout, basically blaming the housing bubble and our financial situation on Greenspan incompetence. Incompetence is often used as a cover-up for what's really going on. Greenspan is quite competent. I assure you the housing bubble and the shift of money out of this country was very well done and very well engineered. It does not reflect incompetence. Everybody was very clear about what the problems were way back then in the 90s. I was in Washington and Wall Street listening to the conversation. So the idea that what happened is incompetence is really a bunch of hooey. On a bigger note, if you step back, we've been watching a lot of indication in the gold world and in the group of people who track the falling of the dollar, a lot of indication that the Anglo-American alliance is on its last legs. I noted one of my partners just sent me a roundup of the S&P global markets for the last 3 years. And it's funny, you step back and look at it. And if you take a look at equity markets, the Anglo-American alliance is doing just well and outperforming the global indices and obviously not outperforming the smaller but growing emerging markets, but doing kind of well. The big question on everybody's mind, though, is what replaces QE2? You know, who's going to keep buying treasuries when the Fed stops? Because the Fed financing of the deficit has absolutely ballooned. It's important to remember, particularly as you watch the oil card game that I referred to, you know, I'm not sure that it's going to be in the interest of the people on this phone conversation to bet against the Anglo-American alliance. There's certainly, you'll hear plenty of criticism of me of what they're doing to manage their way through this. But the reality is of much of what's going on in the world is a competition between different forces. And if the Anglo-American alliance fails, it's going to put many, many of the people on this call in a very weak position. So we all sort of have a, you know, the uncomfortable problem of what I always refer to as the red button problem, which is we're financially dependent on a situation that's or a team that's getting more and more negative and more ugly in what they're doing to manage the situation, and we need to find a positive way out of that. On one final note, there's a very interesting article that I posted on the blog that I just wanted to bring your attention because it's at the heart of all these kinds of stories that we're talking about. And that is that the head of the OECD gave a speech in Finland in February and said capital controls are coming. Well, the reality is what we're looking at in the financial markets are we can either price financial capital at the market, which means I can borrow your capital at a price at which you're willing to lend it, or we can pump out cheap capital as we are doing with the currency debasement QE2 at below market values, steer the capital to the people who are politically approved to do that in the great game of economic warfare, and then try and control the mess that results with more and more rules. And that's really what capital controls are. And literally each week on the Solari Report, I could have a section on capital controls. Let me just give you two things that happened recently. I'm dealing day to day this week with investors who are having money, moving money back in the United States because foreign money managers, as the new financial reform bill gets implemented, are saying, here's your money, please go home. We don't want, you know, we don't want U.S. investors anymore. So that is happening. We don't see a lot of coverage of it, but it's certainly going on day to day to day. The other is we see the final regulations come out on the FBAR, on the foreign financial institution regulations coming out of the U.S. government. That impacts anybody who's got a foreign bank account, or I believe that it applies to gold money accounts as well, and many of the precious metal arrangements abroad. We posted a blog post on the new regs coming out. There's not a lot of change from the old ones, and so if you go to the blog and do a search for FBAR, you'll pick up the one we published last year, and that's pretty much binding. But if you have a foreign bank account or a gold money account, you want to make sure you file your FBAR forms on June 30. But to wrap it up, more capital controls coming. Our hero this week, I always like to get my heroes on the Saleri Report, and it's one of the reasons I'm so excited about Blake Leavitt being on tonight. The hardest thing in the world is to take a highly complex topic on which there's not very much either public understanding or cross-cutting understanding between different expertises, and where there's tremendous uncertainty and lots of vested interest, and create a framework that not only has intellectual integrity, but does it in a way that allows people who are not expert in the field to really understand. And when you take a topic like electromagnetic fields, which is the one that Blake is really, you know, is the go-to person for, in my opinion, it takes tremendous intellectual and emotional courage and just a lot of plain... I have written here on my notes a ton of really hard work. So Blake Leavitt, I'll introduce her in a second after we do Ask Catherine, but Blake Leavitt is really a hero of mine, and I've gone through her work very carefully again in preparation for having her on the Saleri Report, every time I go through it, I have more respect. So we're going to be hearing from an extraordinary person tonight. Two other heroes to point to. Robin O'Brien, who you've heard from me before and is on the DVD list on food, gets an honorable mention. She has a recent article that I posted on the blog, and in it she points out that we spend 9 cents of every dollar on food, but we spend 16 cents of every dollar managing chronic disease. What a great argument for the idea that organic food does not cost as much as you think. But very compelling presentation by Robin, who used to be a stock analyst. And then two, an honorable mention to the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, who said in February in a speech at West Point, are you ready for this? It's up on the blog as quote du jour. Any future defense secretary who advises the president to again send a big American land army into Asia or into Middle East or Africa should have his head examined. That's pretty amazing from the Secretary of Defense. Well, I'm going to skip over Ask Catherine because, in fact, the questions I have I want to put to Blake during our conversation. So let me just go ahead and introduce her. Blake is an award-winning medical and science journalist, a former New York Times writer and author of Electromagnetic Fields, A Consumer's Guide to the Issues and How to Protect Ourselves, for which she won a chapter award of excellence from the American Medical Writers Association. She's also the editor of Cell Towers, Wireless Convenience or Environmental Hazards, and just an amazing all-round expert in the topic of electromagnetic fields and the related technologies. So, Blake, welcome to the Saleri Report.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you, Catherine. Thank you for asking me.
Well, you need to start with your background. How in the world did you come to be the go-to person in this area?
Oh, Lord. I think I was just easily amused when I was a much younger journalist. I was always a generalist in terms of the writing that I did. For years, I wrote for the Litchfield County Times, which is a a weekly newspaper here in Northwest Connecticut where I live, but it's a spectacular weekly and very good award-winning weekly newspaper. And after that, I wrote for the New York Times for a number of years, and then I got my first book contract. And in all of the features that I wrote, you know, whether it was covering premature babies or whether it was covering a new surgical procedure or whether it was covering any number of things, I was always looking for the underlying integration of subjects. And I would often find that when I would go from one interview to another, I would typically be aware of literature that the next doctor that I was interviewing was not aware of. And I was constantly trying to connect dots for between different disciplines. Also, by way of general background, I have 14 MDs in my family and two more in med school. I've come from an all-medical family. And, it's fascinating. But one of the things that I've learned over the years is what the various disciplines do not know about each other. It's as if we've so over-specialized in so many areas of our lives that no one is doing that kind of fundamental integration. So in all of the work that I was doing, I was always looking for the underlying principle that would unite the sciences. And I found that in what is called bioelectromagnetics or biophysics. It's where the non-living sciences sort of crash into the living sciences. The non-living sciences being physics and electromagnetism versus biology and clinical practice. And really, as far as integrative subjects go, that's where the rubber meets the road. That's where we all live. We all live in biophysics and bioelectromagnetics. It's just that we're not aware of it.
Right. One of the things I loved about the book Electromagnetic Field, and one of the things, the audience is just going to have to get used to me saying this. I'm going to plug this book until you absolutely go out and buy it, because it's just such a fabulous introduction to all the different issues. But one of the things you really show in the background is how there really is a separation, either when we look at our health or we look at a variety of a phenomena in the world between, you know, the biology of living things and the various material sciences. And it's very, very useful, not just to integrate this topic, but lots of other topics.
It is. And what's interesting about that is that all of the questions that we have on the table now are not about the physics and the engineering. We know how to make various systems work, whether that's high tension lines or whether that's cellular communications or satellite communications or AM radio, FM radio. We know how to do all of that. None of the questions that exist now have to do with applied physics. All of the questions now have to do with the biological effects to living of species, and it's not just humans. It's all living species that are now in the path of that technology. So all of the questions in the 21st century really are the questions of biophysics. They're not about physics themselves. The thing is that during the 20th century, physics was the top of it was the zenith. It was the nadir for all science. And physicists were used to being listened to as if they were speaking from Mount Olympus, and they had no hesitation about waxing eloquent on subjects that they knew absolutely nothing about, especially biology. And when they were, at their pinnacle right after World War II and during the 1950s and 1960s, in particular during the Cold War years, physicists had a trip, and they still do have a bit of a disdain for biology. The thing is that physicists and engineers are very linear thinking people. They're very can-do, cause and effect kinds of people. For instance, you would not get a computer engineer designing a circuit board unless you knew what every single circuit was going to be for.
Right.
Every single thing is understood. They understand mechanisms, and when they don't understand mechanisms, they stay on it until they do. And that's exactly who you want designing things like telecommunication systems and massive infrastructure. You want people with that kind of a mentality. But when you get involved with biology, you get involved with vast amounts of uncertainty, and you get involved with what are called nonlinear effects. In other words, a small amount of stimulus will create a great impetus on the backside, or on the other side.
And it's very relational. You really need to think relationally, I think.
Oh, very much so. Yeah. But if you think about it, weather is nonlinear. All of biology is nonlinear.
Right.
So the very thing that is fundamental to biology is the thing that drives physicists and engineers crazy. And so you've automatically got a bias there, and you've got a clash that is going to happen. Now, the problem is that it's been the physicists and the engineers are controlling all of the health standards, all of the research, all of the inquiry, all of the way that studies are designed. So what we have are the people who are inventing and creating the technology and the brilliance that goes along with that. They're then trying to architect that and stuff the biological uncertainties into these molds and patterns where it just doesn't fit. And so what we end up with on the backside of that bias are standards that are put in place that really have nothing to do with the nonlinear effects and the more subtle biological responses that are being observed by humans to, you know, things. The latest technology, of course, would be cell phones and cell towers, for instance. That would be the application of it.
Okay, so explain to us, what is an electromagnetic field? And what are the technologies that are now impacting our field?
An electromagnetic field is it's just a physics term, physics theory actually, that has an electrical component and has a magnetic field component. Electromagnetic fields is a broad-based term used to describe everything from the Earth's natural electromagnetic fields all the way up through the ionizing bands of the electromagnetic spectrum for, you know, nuclear activities and cosmic events and gamma rays and, you know, things on the very high end. Let me explain a little bit for your listeners the electromagnetic spectrum is divided into what's called ionizing and non-ionizing radiation. Everybody is familiar with ionizing radiation from X-rays, for instance, and, you know, the caution that is recommended to use lead shields when you're having an X-ray if you're someone of childbearing age or having a dental X-ray or something like that. So people understand that that there are safety concerns with that. Now, the reason there are safety concerns with that is because the ionizing radiation has very, very small wavelengths, and the smaller the wavelength, the more energy it has to knock, for instance, electrons off of their cellular orbit, which can cause mutations. Most people understand that general relationship. The dividing line between ionizing and non-ionizing radiation is in the visible light spectrum. And in human beings, the eyes are the only organ, supposedly, that has been evolved to detect an area of the electromagnetic spectrum, and that would be visible light. The dividing line is thought to be around the ultraviolet range, but visible light is a fairly large swath on the electromagnetic spectrum, and so they're not quite sure where one gives off and the other begins. So there is that a little bit of that uncertainty. In the non-ionizing bands, that includes everything from visible light on down to the Earth's natural electromagnetic fields. Now, most of us don't take in there would be all of our telecommunications technology, television, radio, cellular communications, satellite, infrared bands are in the non-ionizing bands, AM radio, FM radio, radar, a lot of the military applications, a lot of homeland security applications, home security systems, most of our wireless gizmos, our laptop computers, Wi-Fi, all of that is in the non-ionizing bands. Now, there are two points to make here. One is that most people don't understand that we have all living creatures, all plant life, all animal life, all human life, we've all evolved within the Earth's very protective cradle of natural electromagnetic fields. We're in fact entrained by it. The Earth's natural electromagnetic background and the circadian rhythms of humans and various species, there's a very fine harmony that happens in there. The Earth's natural electromagnetic fields are thought to account for migratory patterns in many bird species. Butterflies use the Earth's electromagnetic fields for migration. Same thing with insects. There are particular kinds of bacteria, for instance, that will harmonize themselves to the Earth's electromagnetic fields. Some tree root growth is known to grow differently, you know, depending on where the electromagnetic field of the Earth is stronger or weaker. So we really are in very, very fine harmony with this. Now, what we have done in the last 50 to 60 years is increase a form of artificial energy into this very finely balanced evolutionary envelope that we've evolved in. We've introduced unnatural waveforms. We've introduced unusual signaling characteristics. We've introduced signal strengths in various frequency categories, none of which exists in nature. For instance, your average radio station, for instance, will be broadcasting at somewhere in the range of 50,000 watts in the FM category, if not more. Nothing like that exists in nature, and the signaling characteristics of digital pulsing, nothing like that exists in nature. So we're fooling around with biological systems and energy couplings that we simply have no understanding of where that's going to go. And the picture that's emerging from many studies going back easily to the 1950s is showing that we may have some really serious problems here.
So I sometimes refer to it as electrosmog or electromagnetic pollution.
Yeah, this is a form of energetic air pollution. Electromagnetic fields and the radio frequencies in particular. When I refer to the radio frequencies, that includes all of telecommunications technology. The radio frequencies are a fairly large swath in the non-ionizing bands of the electromagnetic spectrum, and they include all of the telecommunications technologies that we use now.
Right. Well, it's fair to say that cell technology and Wi-Fi technology has really increased this enormously.
There was a study about 6 or 7 years ago. This will give you an idea of how we're increasing the ambient background levels when it comes to these kinds of exposures. There was a study done in Europe of about 10 different European cities. And this was, like I said, a good 8 years ago when it was still, the older analog systems were still in play and the PCS frequencies hadn't come along. And there certainly was no second generation, let alone 3G, let alone 4G networks. None of that had even crossed anybody's mind at that point. And what they did was they went around and they had some baseline studies from maybe 10 or 15 years ago to compare to. And what they did was they went around and they took some ambient background levels, and they had found something like a 3,000% increase over a 10-year period.
Wow.
Of these frequencies, and it was the cell technology that was contributing to it. Now, that by anybody's reckoning is an altered environment.
Now, what do we know about the health impact of non-ionizing radiation?
Oh boy, that's a big one. Non-ionizing radiation affects every single aspect of the human anatomy. There is no aspect of the human anatomy that is not exquisitely sensitive to many of these exposures at intensity levels that are far below what the standards are for these exposures, whether that's the international non-ionizing radiation protection standard, which is called ICNIRP, or in America we'll just call it the FCC standard. I won't delineate it between the IEEE and the National Council of Radiation Protection. People don't really need to know exactly where these standards come from, but those standards that are in effect are for what's called a thermal tissue heating model, which is a very linear. Keep in mind what I said at the beginning about physicists and engineers being the ones that architected all of this. It's a very linear model of this amount of energy coupled with this amount of tissue for this length of period of time will create heat at the cellular level. It's sort of like what happens in a microwave oven. And so what the standards that exist at the Federal Communications Commission, for instance, are for whole body exposures, not individual organ exposures. They're for whole body exposures averaged over a 30-minute period of time, and they will guarantee that you won't get tissue heating. However, that doesn't guarantee that you're not going to get a whole range of other problems.
Right.
Dr. Henry Lai and I, Dr. Lai is at the University of Washington. He heads the Bioelectromagnetics Research Laboratory out there, which is the country's oldest bioelectromagnetics research lab, possibly the world's oldest. Dr. Lai is responsible for discovering both double and single-strand DNA breaks at very, very low-intensity exposures, comparable to cell phone and cell tower exposures today. Now, the reason that that's important is because, keep in mind what I said in the beginning about ionizing radiation, having enough energy to knock electrons off of cellular orbits, therefore causing DNA damage. It has been presumed in allowing these technologies to proliferate, it has been bedrock presumed that there was no such thing as DNA damage caused by these lower frequency non-ionizing exposures. Dr. Lai put the lie to that. No pun intended. He spells his name L-A-I, not L-I-E. Dr. Lai showed, he was the first to show that that in fact DNA damage does occur at these low intensity exposures, which means, to make a long story short, it means that there is essentially no difference between a cell phone and an X-ray. That's the bottom line of that. The only difference is that it will take a little bit longer for that kind of damage to happen at the hands of a cell phone or a wireless router or a Wi-Fi system in somebody's school. It will take a little bit longer to happen, but it will eventually happen. And so what we're beginning to understand now is that the only difference between them is the exposure parameter. It's not the exposure itself. In other words, all energy on some level it is fundamentally the same.
You know, one of the reasons I really think that that getting your book, reading it, understanding this is so important is the electromagnetic field around us is invisible. You know, it's not like a car or a horse or a tree.
A lot of people can sense them, though.
Oh, you can sense it, but it's invisible, and we tend to forget about things if they're invisible. And so
that's true.
If the air is getting more and more polluted, and we see it turning gray, we notice. But we don't see the pollution in the electromagnetic field the same way. And I think it's, so we're a little bit slower to get it. And I think it's very, very important to realize, look, this is very, it may not be visible in the same way that a concrete object is, but it is as real and infinitely more important. And so I think just making it real to people, this thing is real, and it's being manipulated in ways that may not be good. It's an epiphany we all need to have.
That is certainly true. I often describe it as a kind of a process pollution. That electromagnetic fields, apparently the human anatomy, like I said before, it's an exquisitely sensitive electromagnetic organism. You know, think brainwaves, think heartbeats, think cell division itself is electrically stimulated. There isn't anything that happens in us that is not electromagnetically oriented in one way or another. Our sense of direction, for instance, the pituitary gland in the center of the brain is thought to be our magnetic compass. All living systems, including humans, are loaded with a natural magnetic material called magnetite. Birds' beaks and eye areas, for instance, are loaded with magnetite, and it's what they use to sense the Earth's natural magnetic fields. Well, it turns out that a man at the University of California several years ago, Joseph Kirschfink, discovered magnetite in the meninges area that surrounds human brain tissue. Wherever magnetite has been discovered, there's usually a thick range of nerve endings that will go into wherever the magnetite clusters are. Bee bellies, for instance, are known to be almost 100% magnetite clusters, loaded with nerve endings. And bees use magnetite to sense the Earth's electromagnetic fields. As a matter of fact, back I think in 1971, a researcher named Carl von Frisch won the Nobel Prize for describing what was called the honeybee dance, in which honeybees will go out on a sunny day and find the pollinating flowers, and will come back to the beehive and will dance out a very elaborate dance to tell their hive mates, you know, using the Earth's natural electromagnetic field as sort of a vector printout,
right.
Dance out this very elaborate description of where the pollinating flowers are, and off they would all, you know, take to go to that exact location. It's fascinating when you pull back far enough and take a look at how intricately we and other species interact with electromagnetic fields, and then you stand there and you take a look at what it is that we're pumping into the environment. Dr. Robert Becker, in his seminal works, he was my mentor, by the way, but he was publisher of the book Cross Currents and the Body Electric. Dr. Becker called it breathing with the earth. He said that with this infusion of energy into the atmosphere, creating this amount of electrosmog, we're losing our ability to breathe with the earth electromagnetically. And so what we need to
do... It's almost like we're manipulating the vehicle of shared intelligence. We're destroying it.
Well, we're certainly creating a background static so that it's not functioning as clearly as it once did. I started to say that Dr. Lai and I co-authored a paper that came out just this past year in Environmental Reviews in Canada, which is one of the publications of Canada's National Research Council Press. And the paper is called Biological Effects from Exposure to Electromagnetic Radiation Emitted by Cell Tower Base Stations and Other Antenna Arrays. What we did was we took a look at all of the literature that has been published on any biological reactions that happened at very, very low intensity exposures. We did not do a complete literature review. What we did was we focused on the literature of only low intensity exposures to see what, if anything, was there. And we ended up finding 70 studies, over 70 studies, and then we sorted them out, you know, according to were they good, were they bad, did they, you know, have different measurements that we were looking for, like specific absorption rates or things like that. And we ended up with a chart that included 56 studies. But the thing that amazed both of us was that there were almost no negative studies. And what the pattern that seems to be coming about is that the human anatomy appears to have an adaptive response to higher frequency exposures, whereas with the lower intensity exposures, with the lower intensity exposures, we just take that information in like the form of Wiggy Self, is the way I think about it. And
so would
and
that be the Gwen Emergency Network kind of towers?
The Glenn Emergency?
Gwen. In other words, there's an emergency responder network that works at the lower frequencies.
Oh, no. I didn't mean frequency. I meant lower intensity. Higher frequency, lower intensity.
Okay.
So what happens is that the human anatomy just interacts with these fields in a way that our cells take direction from it. If you know anything about cellular physiology, the surface of the cell is loaded with different kinds of portals that will, you know, allow certain chemicals, certain enzymes, you know, to come and go and things like that. Well, it turns out that the information gate that controls whether cellular portals open or close is actually an electromagnetic field. And so if we are introducing exogenous factors into basic cellular biological function without understanding what it is that we're doing, then we're bound to have both adverse and possibly therapeutic effects. That's the problem, is that not all of these exposures may be bad for us. Some of them may actually be therapeutic.
Right. Now let's move to what we can do, because you know, when you realize that all of this is happening and it can have such a profound impact on your on your
home. Well,
people might not
know exactly what it is that's happening. So let me describe some of the symptoms that we found near cell tower base stations and things that were reported in the literature. And this includes both anecdotal reports and epidemiology studies. People were reporting, this is within 1,500 feet, which is about 15 acres worth of distance, 1,500 feet from your average cell tower. And this is before it goes to a 4G network. This is something a lot less complex than that.
Right.
Research has found headaches, skin rashes, sleep disturbances, depression, decreased libido, increased rates of suicide, concentration problems were some of the things that were first noted, dizziness, memory changes, increased risks of numerous kinds of cancers, various kinds of tremors, and other neurophysiological effects in populations that were near there, near base stations, increases in seizure states, things along those lines. So what is being observed is lifestyle kinds of complaints, the immune system suppression that has also been seen with these exposures can be quite profound, because in some circumstances, this will give you an idea of how contradictory the science can become and why it's so difficult to actually study what's going on with these exposures, is that the early science indicated that there is an initial increase in immune system parameters. In other words, the immune system is activated initially with these exposures, which indicates that it's under some form of stress and is reacting to it. So you'll get an increase in immune system parameters, but if you maintain the exposures for a longer duration of time, you'll get an immune system collapse, and there's no comeback after that. That's been observed in numerous cases. So, for instance, when the industry studies cell phone exposures, if they stop the study after, say, 6 months to 8 months to a year to 2 years or something like that, they might actually find fewer brain tumors because you've got an immune system enhancement factor at that point. But if you follow it out 5 to 8 years, you'll find more increases in brain tumors. Do you see how that works?
Yep. Absolutely.
And you see how confusing that can be. Well, the reason, the mechanism that is controlling that goes back to the work of Dr. Martin Blank at Columbia University and his lab mate, lab partner Reba Goodman, having to do with an increase in stress proteins having to do with these exposures. Very, very low intensity, both at power line electromagnetic fields and at radio frequency fields. Increases in stress proteins are an automatic indicator that a living system is in a state of stress. So there are viable mechanisms. One of the things that the physicists and the engineers use to paralyze the conversation so that no changes in public policy recommendations are made is, well, you can't be having these effects. They're all anecdotal because there's no known mechanism. Well, that's just a kind of a ridiculous argument. I mean, we make public policy recommendations and health recommendations all the time without understanding what underlying mechanisms are. All you really need is observed effects, but for some reason the standard of proof that's applied to this area is much more stringent than anywhere else in clinical practice that I've ever seen as a science journalist. And in the meantime, various industries are raking in billions of dollars.
Right. Well, the economics of science that would stop it is, and there's so much money to be made by implementing it, is one of the challenges. So let's look at me, an individual, or me, a household, or a family. Let's say I get your book, I educate myself as to this stuff, how do I protect myself? What do I do?
Oh, there's a lot of things that people can do. One is, I would say the most important thing is try to back away from so many wireless technologies. If you are involved with a cordless phone, cordless domestic phone is not that different from a cell phone. The only difference with that, for instance, would be with a cordless domestic phone, your base station is usually on your kitchen counter as opposed to a cell phone, which is bouncing off of a distant tower. Cut down on cellular phone use. I get complaints all the time from people who are suddenly experiencing sleeplessness and headaches and concentration problems when they put in a wireless computer router.
Right.
Keep your systems wired as much as possible. Ethernet cable will give people a very, very fast internet connection. It just requires you to sit in one place. I mean, we just need to go back to the point of being able to sit down to do what it is that we need to do in terms of, you know, intellectual work or game playing or whatever. Just sit down.
Right.
Designate one place, go back to a desk and stay there. For cell phones themselves, look for a lower SAR model. They're increasingly difficult to try to ferret that information out. There are a couple of websites, I think, that that people can go to, but even that is misleading for various complex reasons. People are recommending that people use headsets instead of putting the cell phone directly against the skull. The antenna against the head is of primary concern. But with the headsets, what people want to look for are hollow tube air headsets as opposed to wired tubes. The reason being that a metal wired earpiece going from the cell phone directly into the ear, metal is conductive and will just deposit the radio frequency radiation that much more efficiently directly into your ear canal. There are probably about 7 studies now that have found increases in acoustic neuromas, which are benign tumors of the inner ear with cell phone exposures, also increases in salivary gland tumors. So what you want to do is to get the cell phone away from your head.
Right.
But I also tell people, you know, choose which organ you want to irradiate, because if you're just attaching your cell phone to your belt loop, then you're irradiating your liver area. There are increases in numerous kinds of cancers with these exposures. What else can people do? Some people are saying text, don't do cell communications. I'm a little leery of that recommendation. On the one hand, it gets the antenna away from the head, but there are 3 studies now that have found increases in melanoma of the eye with cell phone exposures. And, you know, text screens are very small. People hold them right up to their eyes. The eye is an aqueous environment. Water is also conductive. And, you know, will very easily and very efficiently conduct radio frequency radiation directly into the skull through the eye. So bottom line is try to keep your wireless activities to a dull roar. Germany and the European Union now, for instance, recommends that people not abandon their landline phones at home. And cut down on wireless use as much as possible. France has outlawed Wi-Fi throughout the national library system there because librarians
Wow.
were being made ill. Yep, librarians were being made ill. The German government recommends, and the European Union recommends, that people of childbearing age not use wireless laptops on their laps for fertility reasons. These are the kinds of recommendations, prudent avoidance and a precautionary principle recommendations, that are widely made throughout Europe. They also recommend that children under the age of 16 not be allowed to use cell phones or wireless products except in cases of emergency. Something called electromagnetic hypersensitivity syndrome is increasing transculturally. It's popping up in all corners of the world these days. In Sweden, it's called electric allergy. It's also considered a functional disability in Sweden. There are areas in Sweden in public buildings and in beaches and in parks that are declared wireless-free areas so that people with EHS can, you know, live, can participate in civic life there, like other people with functional disabilities. But EHS is a growing problem.
One of the reasons I really encourage, another reason I really encourage people to read your book, is I bump into a lot of people who have a health problem but haven't been able to figure out what's causing it.
Yeah.
And I always feel that this is something people ought to think about and, you know, see if they can reduce their exposure and see if that helps.
People have had tremendous success when they reduce their exposures if they catch it soon enough.
Right.
The problem is that when you get into a full-blown EHS situation, people very often have to go to very drastic measures. They have to shield their houses. They have to do some rewiring. One of the things that people can do to reduce their exposures, not just for wireless products, you know, like wireless routers and things like that, is to take out light-dimming switches, for instance, which can cause what are called harmonics on the lines. Harmonics are higher frequencies that are married to the lower power line frequencies, and so you end up with a multi-frequency exposure from things like that. You can also get some harmonics on the lines. One of the euphemisms that's used is called dirty electricity. It's actually an industry term, and what we're doing is we're creating now so much dirty electricity with the higher frequency products that we're using, like cell phones and iPhones and iPads and all of the battery chargers that we plug into our domestic lines, that we're just putting so many more frequencies on the domestic power supply that the dirty aspect of it in industry parlance is just increasing exponentially. I was going to say one of the other problems is that since there is so much of that in the power distribution network, they used to return all power back to the distribution station. Now they're just sort of dumping it off directly into the ground at all points along the way, which is causing problems. It's causing abnormal ground currents in a lot of neighborhoods. There are real problems with that now too.
I really want to ask this question, so I'm going to take some liberties and run over a little bit tonight. We got a question earlier this afternoon, and let me just read it to you, because it's one, Blake, that I've gotten from several subscribers in California and also friends who are very concerned. Here's what it says. My question is about smart meters. I've had one installed on my home against my wishes. I've been informed that once installed, it will not be removed. I'm concerned about the health implications of this, not only from the meter on my home, but as I understand it, multiple smart meters in the same area communicate with each other. What kind of exposure am I and my neighborhood being exposed to by smart meters in the smart grid? I live in California, and as of today, nearly 13 million smart meters have been installed in the state. Once an additional 4 to 5 million are installed, every home and business will have one. The CA Public Utility Commission, the utility companies, assure us that the EMF are very low and not a health risk. Despite their assurances, I still do not want one in my home, but I do not have a choice. There's no opt-out option. Do you or your guests have any information about the health implications of smart meters in the smart grid?
Oh, yes. California, bless their hearts. They are in an absolute uproar out there over smart grids. I started sending out information on smart grid proposals over 2.5-3 years ago, long before California even passed its legislation. California was the first state to begin this build out. Part of the stimulus dollars through the Obama administration and the Department of Energy. It's a way over engineered concept. It's a very dangerous concept. Smart grid technologies will turn every single appliance in our homes into the equivalent of a transmitting cell phone. They intend to go completely wireless. A lot of the newer appliances now are being equipped with transmitters that will transmit to a meter on the outside of the house that will then transmit to a central utility hub that will transmit somewhere else. Talk about introducing a whole new layer of electrosmog that is absolutely involuntary. And the exposures are dangerous exposures because it's called the duty cycle. When the duty cycle kicks in, there is a higher peak exposure pulse that will happen for a fraction of a second. But that peak exposure more than likely exceeds the FCC standards. The problem is that the way the FCC figures out their standards is to average them into other standards that has the ability to make that peak exposure essentially disappear. But that doesn't mean that it is not a, a biologically important exposure to living systems. Now, the problem with smart meters that are attached to people's homes, as a matter of fact, there's recent legislation proposals in California. I just got an email today that was calling for a complete state shutdown until they understood more of what it is that's going on. And there is a PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric, out there is considering letting people opt out. There are all kinds of resources for people that are concerned about this now. There's a woman named Sandy Maurer, S-A-N-D-I-M-A-U-E-R. If you just Google her, her website will come up. There's a lot of good information on there. Cindy Sage is the co-editor of the Bioinitiative Report. Some of your listeners might be aware of what that is. If they're not, they can go to www.bioinitiative, B-I-O-I-N-I-T-I-A-V-E, bioinitiative.org. You'll get an idea of what that's about. Cindy also has been putting together reports trying to really delineate what these exposures are. She's grabbed a tiger by the tail out there because the Electric Power Research Institute issued a counter report that is just really the silliest piece of writing that I've seen in an awfully long time. So there's a lot to sort out there. In the meantime, the listener that sent in that email is certainly right to be concerned, needs to contact Pacific Gas and Electric, tell them that she wants that meter removed from her house as much as possible, as soon as possible. If there's any kind of an opt-out campaign, she needs to institute that immediately. Do you need me to stop talking?
No. That's great because this has come up several times. And
the state of Connecticut, by the way, our Attorney General out here just asked our technology committee in the state Senate to not back smart grid build outs. Ask them to turn it down, and not necessarily on health issues. There are really significant privacy issues. There are safety issues. New Zealand, for instance, has huge areas of New Zealand have outlawed smart grids because they were starting fires. Smart meters were starting fires. There's some sort of a problem with the stepping up and down between the various frequencies require different voltages. Appliances like ceiling fans are running backwards. They're burning out circuit boards. There's actually some question about whether smart grids will even save energy. I mean, that's their entire reason for coming into existence, was to save energy, was to give people access to real-time energy use so that they could, do their laundry at midnight as opposed to, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon when they get home from work. But in reality, for instance, Connecticut had a pilot program in 2009 of something like 10,000 customers, and they found that there was no substantial utility of energy savings at all. But the other problem is that nobody has really factored in how much a vampire energy is being created with all of these additional antennas.
Right.
For instance, if you think of your television set, environmentalists will tell you that unless you unplug your television set or any remote-controlled appliance, unless you unplug it, it's never completely off. Otherwise, it wouldn't be able to receive the signal to turn back on again. So nobody has factored in vampire energy use when we turn the entire every single appliance in our house, and the average home has at least 15 appliances between the coffee maker and the furnace and the air conditioner and the stove and the oven and the microwave and the computer. I mean, you just keep going and going. Everything that plugs into the wall is going to have an antenna attached to it. That's really significant vampire energy use. The other problem is that do consumers really want the utility companies? These are two-way communication systems, so that
right.
The utility company can cycle your appliances on and off for you. Well, I don't want them doing that for me.
Trouble with the utility companies when I have control within the house.
Yeah, but then there's this other little problem called radio frequency interference, in which it's very easy to monkey wrench some of these signals. And although the signals are supposed to be encrypted, the possibility of a stray cell phone, turning your oven or your furnace on or off when you're not home is very real. So
you're looking at a potentially very stupid grid.
a very stupid grid, very dangerous grid. It's also been shown, it's also been demonstrated through security firms that you can very easily infect the entire grid through one smart meter by planting viruses and worms inside of them. So it's a national security threat. It's a personal security threat. Real-time energy measurement like that will also cue people when you're home, when you're not. It's a disaster. Very ill-conceived system. It came out of the minds of General Electric and Siemens Corporation and IBM. Excuse me, IBM in particular. They're the ones that that are making literally billions of dollars already. IBM is manufacturing the various computer interfaces, and General Electric is the largest manufacturer of smart grids in the world, or smart meters in the world. And this all came through environmental channels, environmentalists just not doing enough homework, deciding at some point that they wanted to partner with industry, and this is the result of it. It's a disaster, and people should fight it. Maine is fighting it. Virginia has stopped the installation of some smart meters, but again, not on health reasons, for other reasons. As far as I'm concerned, for whatever reason these systems are turned down, it's a good one.
Well, left to my own device, I could talk to you forever, but I have to call it close. We've gone over, but quickly, Blake, just tell us how we can access your work. I'm going to say again, if I haven't said it before, this is a must-get, must-read book, Electromagnetic Field by Blake Leavitt. I cannot recommend it strongly enough, but in addition to your book, how can we stay in touch? How can we watch what you're doing? How can we support your efforts?
Well, I have a website through the Authors Guild that I need to update. For some reason, I just don't go there often enough and pay enough attention to it. I'm usually too busy working to pay attention to image very, very much. But the website is Blake Leavitt, BlakeLevitt.com. My books are listed there. There's also a very good documentary to recommend to your listeners called Full Signal, which is a good exploration of this subject. It was made by a documentary filmmaker from Israel, and people can access that. There's even a trailer on their website. You can access that through www.fullsignalmovie.com. Which is very good. And anyone who wants to look at any of the history of this, a researcher named Magda Havas at the University of Trent up in Canada has gotten her hands on some very, very old archives going back to the 1960s, and she's gradually scanning them into her website. But if you just Google Magda, M-A-G-D-A, Havas, H-A-V-A-S, her website will come up too. So those are three things for people to go and look at. And for smart grid information, go to Sandy Maurer's website. Just Google Sandy, S-A-N-D-I, M-A-U-R-E-R. M-A-U-R-E-R, sorry.
Well, Blake, you are my hero, and I think you're a national, if not an international treasure. So
well, I hope I can live up to that estimation there.
No, just be yourself and don't change. And, you know, if there's anything...
Not sure I have a choice.
If there's anything here at Solaria we can ever do to support your work, you know, or anything you want to discuss with our audience, just let us know. You're back on the Solaria Report whenever you want. Okay?
Well, why don't you have me back on? We'll do smart grids, and we'll talk about cost shifting onto other segments of society. And we'll talk about what people can do at the federal level, because almost all of these problems start there.
I would love to. That's a plan. I'm going to schedule you very shortly. So have a wonderful evening.
Thank you. You too.
Ladies and gentlemen, coming up on March 10th, Precious Metals Market Report, I want to talk about, you know, we've been watching the market continue up and very strong, what that means and what it means to what the next 3 to 6 months might look like. A lot to discuss there. March 17th, we have a new addition to the schedule, Janine Roth, New York Times bestseller, written many best-selling books, mostly on food. The last one, number one on the list, big promotion on Oprah, God, Food, and Women, now has published a book called Lost and Found about losing her fortune as one of the people who had her money in Madoff. She was introduced to us by the wonderful Mayori Onerheim, who was on the Solari Report, wonderful CPA, whose website, Money is Spiritual Practice, is a real gem and treasure. Anyway, Janine Roth, we're going to be talking about her new book about the Madoff experience and what it tells you about our relationship with money on March 17th. And then March 24th, Dr. Gwen Scott on mitigating the impact of aerosol spraying, a.k.a. chemtrails, on your health. So until next week with Precious Metals Report, I'll be with Franklin Sanders back in Tennessee. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.